Welcome to the Plain Dealing Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. I'm Adam Miller, the preacher here at the Plain Dealing Church of Christ. In this week's sermon, we continue our series on building biblical families. This is part two. If you haven't listened to part one, you may want to go back and listen to that. It was from last Sunday, the 7th. This one was from 5 and 14 of 2023. Part two, we're going to get into the concept of marriage as God brings these similar yet unique beings, Adam and Eve, man and woman, together to form marriage. And marriage is the basic building block of the home and also intended to be the basic building block of our society. And so we talk about marriage, we talk about the model of marriage, the mechanics of marriage, and the real meaning of marriage, which is to glorify God. And so we hope the sermon is a blessing for you. Hope that we can dig into the scriptures to find out how we should live in our married lives and why that's the best way for man to live and why it is a blessing not only in our homes but also in our societies. Hope you enjoy the sermon. We'd like for you to subscribe and share our page, whether you're listening on a podcast app or if you're listening directly through Substack. Either way, make sure you subscribe, follow, whatever you need to do to make sure you don't miss future content. And here's our sermon, Building Biblical Families, Marriage. And so today, as we think about mothers, we honor mothers, our sermon series intersects with that in some small way, although next week we'll be talking about children. But here in the month of May, we are talking about the family. Miss Sheila, would you I'm going to have to keep relying on you. I'm so sorry for that. One more time. We're going to be talking about building biblical families this month. And last week, we talked about the basic structure of man. We went to the very beginning and we saw that one of the most important things to understand about families is to understand that the people who comprise families are people crafted and made in the image and likeness of Almighty God. Over and over again in Genesis 1, 27, 26, 27, and then again in Genesis 5, verses 1 and 2, God makes that statement. We looked at that last week. In the image of God, He created them. Male and female, He created them. And so throughout that text, we looked at this idea that God is using the family, and God intended the family to be the basic building block of human society. And we see that today it's still the case. You know, when we look at biblical wisdom, when we look at God's wisdom, it's so interesting that today when people, social scientists, will talk about marriage and where did marriage come from, they'll say, well, you know, this developed over years. People saw that as the best system to keep from, you know, jealousy and that sort of thing. And one must ask, you know, if that's the case, if marriage is just the product of cultural development, then why is it that every generation seems to want to drift away from that? And we're living in a world today where marriage is really disparaged more than it is celebrated. And on every television show and in jokes, you know, when young people get married, we've got a couple young people that we're familiar with. Brooke is getting married this summer, and we've got some other friends and people that are getting married. And so many times we'll hear things about, well, you know, you're losing your freedom, or somebody will joke, we're going to a funeral. Oh, I mean a wedding, things like that. And you know, they may seem harmless enough, but what we're really doing is we're giving fuel to this fire that marriage is really not a good thing, that it's not a positive thing. And I want to change that this morning. Last week's sermon was pretty tough, pretty hard, had some dark to it and some heaviness to it. This week we're going to try and keep everything light and a little more cheer. We're going to look at the positive of this, and hopefully it will be a blessing for all of us. And so our key text for this entire series is Psalm 127 and verse 1, where the psalmist says, "Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it, or those who build it labor in vain." And so what he is saying there in that text is that at the cornerstone of our homes should be God. And if God is at the cornerstone of our homes, then by definition, God's plan for our homes should follow. And hey, it worked. So we'll see. We'll see. I'm going to try. The first thing we want to notice here is that God's ordained design for family is marriage. Now, let me just say, and I said this last week, and I want to say it again today, and I'm going to reiterate it again next week. I understand that Mother's Day is a two-edged sword. When I was a young preacher, I'd get up, I'd preach on Mother's Day, I'd always congratulate, and I really didn't realize for many years until I got to know people who had just recently lost a mother. And then I got to talking to people who were never able to be mothers, or those who maybe had a strained relationship with a mother, that these things can kind of have a dual edge to them. There can be a cut on the backside of that. And so there's always someone in the congregation who maybe this is their first or second year being at church without a mother. Or maybe they stop and it really, you know, all the mothers being celebrated, they've been trying for years and they've struggled with infertility. And so that's those things are horribly difficult. And when we talk about marriage today, it may be that we're going to be talking about some who have been through a divorce. It may be that your spouse died. It may be that you never found anyone to marry. Maybe you had that love of your life. I knew someone one time, they dated one woman, a man. He dated her for years, thought he'd marry her. She never wanted to get married. And then he never could find the willpower, desire, whatever to date again. It broke his heart. And he is, past marrying age at this point. He's on up in age and he's just going to die a bachelor, presumably. And, sometimes those sort of things happen. And so these things, when we talk about exceptions, we're not demonizing those people. I want to be very clear about that. If I talk about how good mothers are, we're not demonizing people who don't have children. If we're talking about how God's plan is marriage, we're not demonizing those who've been divorced or those who choose not to marry or those who are widowed or something like that. And in fact, we have great sympathy for those people. And we need to talk about those. In fact, the last Sunday of the month, the fourth Sunday of the month, the whole sermon is going to be devoted to, families that don't fit this mold. And how we in the church need to make sure we're ministering to these people and loving these people. And how they sometimes can be better servants in the kingdom of God than those who are in the mold. And we'll talk about that. That's one of the interesting things. But as we progress in the series, one thing we need to understand is that marriage is in fact God's ordained design for the family. And so when we think about what God wants the family to look like, Ms. Sheila, I'm going to need your help. And it works. We're going to go back to Genesis chapter 2. Now, last week we spent a lot of time in this text. We're just going to touch on it today because we did spend so much time in it last week. But in Genesis chapter 2, verses 18 through 25, the Bible says that God saw man, the man he had made, and it was not good. It was not good that man should be alone. Now, if you're paying attention in Genesis, and if you're reading it from front to back, don't take very much. God made everything on the first day. He made light, made darkness, and it was good. And he made on the second day, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good. Verse 31 of Genesis 1, when God rests from all his creative work, he sees everything he's made, and what? It was very good. And so if you're reading Genesis from Genesis 1 on into chapter 2, everything so far is good. And within God's creative framework, God found a thing that was not good. This is very important. This isn't a sin. This isn't a result of the fall. But as God had made it, creation wasn't yet complete. And so what we see is in fact, Genesis 1:31, if you read that text, and we talked about this last week, actually comes after the creation of male and female, when God saw it was very good. And so what happens on the sixth day is while God is making man and while God's making the land animals and things, in the middle of that, he gets to a point where man is made, and God says, this isn't good yet. It's not good that man should be alone. Because Genesis 2 is sort of a magnifying glass look at Genesis chapter 1, 26 and 27, where God made male and female in his image. And so Genesis chapter 2, God says, these creatures, among all the other days of things that I've created, these creatures deserve a whole chapter. And so chapter 2 is about the formation of man and about family. And God says, let me talk a little bit more about that. And so when he makes man, he says, well, it's not good that man be alone. He says, I will make a helper comparable to him. That word in the Hebrew is so interesting. And I think I've mentioned this here in the past, but I'll mention it again. The word ezer is in there. That word helper, comparable. The word helper there is the word ezer. And you say ezer, like Ebenezer, like an Ebenezer Scrooge. Well, have you ever sung the old hymn that says, here I raise my Ebenezer, right? And I remember as a kid thinking, what in the world does the Christmas Carol and Ebenezer Scrooge have to do with this song we're singing in church? And maybe you've had that weird things like that even now as an adult. And so I was wondering, what is Ebenezer all about? Well, in the Scriptures, there's a story about when the people of God
dedicate a rock. They raise a stone, and it's called the Ebenezer, the stone of help. Eben is stone. And they raise this stone and say, it's by God's help that we have come this far. And that word help there is the word Ezer. It's the same word found there, and I will make man a helper comparable for him. Now, here's the point I want to make very clearly this morning. Sometimes when we think of a helper, we think of someone who's a sidekick or unimportant, like Batman and Robin. Right? And Robin don't get his own movies. In fact, Robin, if the franchise is going well, might get on the second or third movie, but Robin don't count. Batman's the important one. And I think sometimes we might think in terms of that when we think of helper. Like, well, here's the carpenter, but this is his helper. Here's the plumber, but this is his helper. Here's the welder, but here's his helper. Here's the engineer, but here's his helper. Here's the doctor, and here's his helper. And in all those circumstances, everyone would say, well, the really important one was the first one. But that's not what the word help comparable means. It's the Hebrew word Ezer. And the word always, in fact, the majority of the time in the Old Testament, when you do a concordance search on it, where you just search the word and look, the majority of the time the word is used, it's in reference not to woman, but to God. That God is our help. And so when we think about that, I hope that will reframe our thinking of what it means when God made a woman for the man. God said, this situation is not good. I'm going to send woman to his rescue. And so that's why our next text on the board, Proverbs 18 and verse 22, says that he who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. When a man marries, that's a wonderful thing. Marriage is not the old ball and chain. It's not going to a funeral. It's not the end of your good old days. You know, a lot of people frame things that way, but that's not the way it happens. In Proverbs 19:14, the Proverbs writer says that house and wealth are inherited from fathers, but a prudent wife is what? From the Lord. He says your parents can give you a house, but if you find a good wife, that's a blessing from God. And so today when we're talking about marriage, the very first thing we want to talk about is this was God's ordained plan, and it's in God's wisdom and in God's plan that we have this system where wives are a part of it. Sheila, would you give me one more click there, please? And so the Proverbs writer says in Proverbs 31 and verse 10, an excellent wife who can find? She is far more precious than jewels. And so this is God's structure. Now, next slide, if you would, please. And go ahead and you can click about three or four times for me there. So let's go back very quickly. And in Genesis chapter 2, verses 18 through 25, God brings this woman to the man. And remember, we read it last week. Man said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She should be called woman because she was taken out of a man. And therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Now, if you weren't here last week, here's the highlights from that text. Number one, man and woman were distinct and yet the same. Adam says, this is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She was taken out of man. She's distinct from man, and yet she's made from man, so she's the same as man. So there is a similarity between husband and wife, and yet there is a huge distinction between man. And we all know this, right? We've seen the books. Men are from Mars and women are from Venus. Or I may have gotten that, you know. Anyway, men are like, my favorite one is men are like waffles and women are like spaghetti. That's a great book. You ought to read that. We're all different, right? We're distinct. But God brings them together and the two became one flesh. They became one unit. Now, what was so interesting about that last week, remember, is that to make woman, God removed something from man. And the implication was, is without the woman, the man was no longer whole. And so when God brought the woman back to the man, now man's been made whole again. There's this beautiful metaphor there that now he is back to 100% completeness because his helper, his Ezer, is there. So the jigsaw puzzle has been put back together, but now it's in the form of the wife. And so Jesus in Matthew chapter 19, when he's being asked about divorce, you know, they're saying, hey, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? And Jesus says, well, no, have you not read in the beginning that God made them male and female, and the man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And therefore, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. And so there is a principle there that Jesus endorses in his teaching that when a man and a woman come together, there's a few things that happen here. Number one, there's the distinct yet similar beings who are joined. But number two, and this may be very important for you, I don't know. When a man and a woman, when a man, before he marries, before he can marry, he has to leave his father and mother. And what that means is you've got to start your own family. And you're no longer part of mom and dad's family. You're starting your own. Now, that don't mean you're disinherited. I'm not talking about legal inheritance. I don't mean you don't go over for Thanksgiving or something like that. But what I mean is that the man is now freed from the authority of his parents at that point. Okay, up until that point, and we'll look at this next week, the Bible would say, children, obey your parents in the Lord. But when the man leaves his father and mother, now, you know, mom and dad want to eat peanut butter and jelly every day, but I want to eat ham. Okay, well, I can go buy my own ham, right, or whatever. And I'm sure it's going to be much more complex than that. In fact, it is. Because many of the problems that happen in marriages are due to in-law instigation, right? The mom and dad are still trying to control their child after they've started a new family. And so it's very important for children to tell their parents, and you know, if they're interfering in this new family, hey, you need to step back. And parents, if you have children who get married, it's very important that you tell yourself, I'm not going to interfere. Well, what if they make a mistake? That's how they learn. That's how you learn. What if they go without food? They'll sell something. And you know, I've told this story before. Before Caleb was born, when he was almost here, there was a week where literally we had like $7 in our bank account and we're praying that something we've forgotten to write or something out there didn't come through the bank. Broke as a skunk. And I'm literally, and I'm about to go sell some. I've talked to people who got married back in the 40s and 50s, and they talk about selling their class rings when they got married, or selling other things so they could afford to buy food. You know, those times are what forged that relationship. And I remember I got a $35 check in the mail because I'd gone and led singing for a congregation. Didn't even know they were going to pay me. Mailed me a check, and that $35 we feasted on like beans for a week until I got my next real paycheck. You know, sometimes that's how it be, as they say. Sometimes that's how it is. And parents' intuition is, I'm going to keep providing for and taking care of my baby. They're no longer your baby. That's so important. And so this is the model of marriage. A man leaves his father and mother and he's joined to his wife. And we talked about last week, that's that concreting together. And God, Jesus says what God has joined together. The passage last week that I messed up, I said Malachi, Micah, but it was actually Malachi chapter 2, there in verses 15, 16, 17. God says the reason I put my spirit in your marriage is so that you would glorify God and have offspring who would glorify God. And that's a beautiful passage and it's a beautiful model. And what God does is God is involved in every marriage between man and woman, and He joins them together and He puts them together. So just what Jesus says, what God joins together. It really doesn't matter if you know, what did you sign? I had a young couple one time, I did their wedding. And everyone had gone down and done the reception and the cake and the throwing the bouquet, all the stuff you do. And they got out in the car and they blew the bubbles and they drove off. And everyone left the church building and I'm picking up and, you know, doing the stuff, picking up this, picking up that. And I look and there's the marriage license. Not the fake one that they'd signed for the camera, the legal one that it's the preacher's responsibility to take to the courthouse within 14 days. And so I called them and I said, where y'all at? And I said, oh, we're about 10 miles up the road. And I said, I hate to interrupt your honeymoon already. You need to come back to the building. Why? You ain't legal, right? And so they were going to be gone for several days. There was a question about whether we could. Anyway, they were married. They were married. They had made vows before God Almighty. And they were married. Now, we are to obey the laws of the land, and so we got the license signed, turned it into the courthouse. But an issuance of that licensure did not make them husband and wife. That recorded it for legal purposes and tax purposes and property sharing and all that other stuff, right, that we talk about, and insurance and all the things that we've entangled in somehow with government. But marriage is a union between two people and God. And so when we start messing with our marriage covenants and we start deciding to break those up, what we're doing is we're not just messing with another person, we're messing with what God has done. I want us to understand that. And that's why divorce and ending marriages is so damaging, is because not just, you know, last week we talked about when you cement two things together and you try to pull them apart, you always destroy the component parts. Well, there's something else that's going on there, and that is when a marriage is broken apart, we are breaking up what God did. We are destroying, tearing down God's work. And you don't tear down God's work lightly as people of God. You're going to do some spiritual damage there to someone or everyone involved. It's not just this casual thing today where, oh, we got married, things just didn't work out, and we're still best friends. I've never understood the "we're still best friends" thing. Well, if you're still best friends, then you ought to still be married, because that's what God wants you to be. Well, we couldn't be husband and wife, we can still be best friends. That's nonsense. That's selfish child talk. And so here, the purpose, and it's spelled out in Ecclesiastes 9:9, enjoy life with the wife whom you love. How long? All the days of your... I love this, you know, emo Solomon. All the vain days of your life that God has given you under the sun, because that's your portion in life and your toil at which you tore under the sun. He says, what did God do? What does God want you to do? He wants you to enjoy the wife you married for your whole life. That's the plan. Ms. Sheila, would you give us the next slide? And you can go ahead and just... Beautiful. Thank you. So let's talk about a few things very quickly. First, we talked about the model of marriage. This is what it looks like. Marriage is God brings this woman to the man. They're married. They stay married for life. That's the plan. The second thing we want to talk about this morning from a biblical perspective is the mechanics of marriage. Now, in Amos chapter 3 and verse 3, Amos asks this rhetorical question. And I want to be clear, he's not talking about marriage. He's talking about man's relationship to God. And he says, can two walk together unless they are agreed? But his point is, to the people of God, he's saying, if you're living and thinking and acting differently than the God you try to serve, how can you then turn around and say, I'm walking with God? That's a great sermon and a great lesson for us today. You know, there are a lot of people who say, well, I'm a Christian, but they're not walking with Christ. You know, John said in 1 John 2 and verse 6, he says, he who says he abides in him ought himself to walk even as he walked. And that is, if you're going to be in concert with Jesus Christ, that is, you're going to claim to be in fellowship with him, you've got to agree on daily life. Guess what? Two people cannot be married unless they are walking in agreement. I'm aware of someone, and I'm just going to leave it as generic as I can since we record these. But they told me one time that their spouse lived, they had a vacation lake type home, and they had their permanent home. And they said, one of us lives in one house and one of us lives in the other, and we kind of visit every few weeks, and we both are a lot happier that way. Well, those two are not walking together. That's not God's pattern. You know, I don't know what they're doing aside from that, but they're just kind of keeping the legal things together, maybe for the children or something like that. I don't know. But that's not the idea here. And so I want to talk a little bit this morning about the mechanics of marriage, and I assume that some will probably disagree with some of these. I just want to point this out, whether it's this week, last week, next week. I'm doing my very best not to insert Adam's opinion on the subject. So let's go to Ephesians chapter 5, Colossians chapter 3, and 1 Peter chapter 3. And we're going to see two similar parallel ideas that permeate all three of these passages. And it has to do with how marriage works, how marriage functions. How do we get along? How do I stay married to this man or this woman? And I want to be clear, I am not standing here before you this morning saying I'm a marriage expert. And Melissa will testify to that. Okay? I don't have it all figured out. I'm not the perfect husband. I'm not saying do it like me. I'm not. I'm saying this is what God says. And the verses I'm about to read, they pierce my heart as much as they will anyone's else. Because God calls husbands and wives to a high calling. Marriage is not, you know, I think so many in our culture have been corrupted because we grew up watching, my age at least, we grew up watching the Disney romances and the princess and the prince gets the princess and it's romance and everyone's happy and everyone's singing and we get home and there's dirty dishes and the baby starts crying and there's bills on the table and this is not my fairy tale romance. Something's wrong. But what we're going to see is the biblical view of marriage. It helps us deal with those dirty dishes and that crying baby and those bills on the table. It's not a fairy tale where everyone's happy and, oh, I met my soulmate and, oh, well, we just fell out of love. So we're still best friends, but we're going to see other people. You know, that cultural mindset that permeates so many today. And so in Ephesians 5, we'll begin in the longest reading here, verses 22 through 23. And in my mind, the best single text in all the Bible about marriage. If you want to say, what's marriage all about? Go to Ephesians 5, 22 through 33. This text is imperative. And it begins in verse 22. Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. He says, now as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Now, ladies, if you've tuned out the text, please hold on for the next few. It gets much better for you. Men, if you're feeling proud, buckle up. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Again, pulling from Genesis. This mystery is profound, and I am saying that it refers to Christ and the church. However, let each one of you love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. Now hold that thought. We're going to come back to Ephesians 5 and use this as our explainer for the mechanics. But I want to look at what is said in Colossians 3 and also in 1 Peter 3 very quickly. And then we'll see that they're in concert. That Paul's writing Colossians, Peter's writing in 1 Peter, but the message is the same. So in Colossians chapter 3, beginning here in verse 18, Paul says here, wives, submit to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. Let's go to 1 Peter 3. In 1 Peter chapter 3, Peter gives very similar advice. He says in verse 1, likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, there may be one without a word by the conduct of their wives, when they see your respectful and pure conduct. And then he goes into a discussion about Christian beauty. And this is so important to understand in its cultural connotation. Before we read this, I didn't even realize this till recently. But during the first and second century in the Roman world, the Roman thing for ladies was this really exquisite and fancy hair braiding and hairstyles with ornate jewels. And we know this, interestingly enough, because of the Roman sculptures that we have unearthed in places like Pompeii from these dates, where women had these just extravagant hair braids and things. And so what Paul is doing is saying the current cultural standard of beauty is to get these extravagant and expensive hair braids and wear all this jewelry. And so now let's read it in that context. He says, do not let your adorning be external, the braiding of the hair and the putting on of gold jewelry or the clothing you wear, but let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is in God's sight is very precious. And he goes on to talk, and then look, men, in verse 7, likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as to the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life. Listen to this. So that your prayers may not be hindered. No. File that one away. Let's go back to Ephesians. And I want to draw out just a few. By the way, meditate on the... If you say, well, we're having marriage trouble, won't marriage be better? We'd like our marriage to work better. go and meditate on these texts. But let's draw a few things out very quickly. First of all, since Paul puts wives first, we'll begin with the wives. Paul says, Peter says, that women should do what? They should submit to their husbands. And there's nothing in our current culture that is any more reproachable than the idea of that. In fact, Paul, Peter would be called chauvinistic for putting forth this idea. I'm not going to have any man tell me what to do. Heard one time of a bride who told the preacher, went in to meet with the preacher, we're getting married, and said, I don't care what you say in our wedding, but you don't dare tell me I've got to obey him. Well, let me talk about this for just a moment. There's at least two things we need to take into consideration. The first one is that Paul and Peter both say, submit your own husbands as to the Lord. And then I want you to look at the type of man that is implied you are submitting to in that relationship. In both cases, and specifically in the book of Ephesians, Paul is talking about a man who would lay down his life on the cross for you. I understand that in the early 20th century, through the mid-20th century, and I've heard tales of men who, I rule the roost around here, this is my house, we're going to do what I want to do. That's not what Paul is saying here. Paul is talking about women, do not try to domineer and downgrade and denigrate your husband. Honor him as if he is the head of your home and give him respect. Now, it's interesting in verse 33, the end of that passage, verses 22 through 33, in verse 33 of Ephesians 5, Paul gives sort of a summation of what he just said, and he says, husbands should love them wives themselves, and let the wives see that they respect. Now, in the old King James Version, that word, if any of you still have that Bible, is what? It's not respect, it's reverence. It's the word revere. See, the wife, see that she reveres her husband. And you know, we have this thing in our culture today. I hear a lot of people say, well, if you want to get respect, you've got to what? Give respect. Or if you want to get respect, you've got to earn it. Some of y'all may have said that. The word here in the Greek in verse 33 is not respect, like the kind of respect I give when someone achieves something. It is the word reverence, which means you respect them because of who they are. Now here's how this works. If a policeman pulls me over, it might be the most crooked policeman in all the country. But I'm still going to say, yes, sir, officer. And I'm still going to give him my license and my insurance. Why? Because of the human he is and he's earned my respect? No, because of the office he holds. I may not like the things our president does or the former president. You pick the one you do or don't like. Maybe you don't like any of them. You may not like the things the president does or the mayor does or the governor does. But when you're in their presence, you are going to treat them with the honor that they deserve because of the office they hold. And so what Peter is saying here to the wives is, they're saying, women, you respect your husband not because he's a great man or he treats you just right or does everything just right or he's the smartest man you've ever, but because he's your husband. And you know, there's something we need to think about here. You know, recently I was listening to someone and he made a great point. He said, you know, when we downgrade our spouse, we're really talking bad about our ability to choose another human. Think about that. If I say, well, you know, some woman says, well, my husband's dumb and he's lazy and he don't know how to do anything. Then the follow-up, the natural question is, why did you marry that person then, right? You're talking about your poor ability to choose a future mate. And so what Paul and Peter are saying is, now I understand they may have been in a culture where there were arranged marriages. We live in a culture where you probably had some say-so in whether or not you said, I do, right? And so what he's saying is, if you at one time thought this person would be a good spouse, then at least give them that respect and honor they're due. Now, flip it around for the men. Husbands, you're the head of the home. What does that mean? It doesn't mean you get your way. It means you get to give up everything you are. That's what it means to be the leader in the church. What did Jesus say? The one who is last shall be first, and the first shall be last. Jesus, the head of the church, Ephesians 1, 22 and 23, took off his garment, girded himself with a towel, got on his hands and knees and washed the feet of his apostles. And he said, in my kingdom, this is how it goes. And here Paul says, husbands, that's how you lead your wife. Like Christ loved the church and was willing to die for her. Now, I've asked women before, and I've never heard a no, and I'm sincerely asking this, especially for our younger ladies, and for our older women as well. If you could find a man who loved you so much that he would sacrifice his entire self and do everything to make you happy and give himself on the altar of life so that you could be blessed, wouldn't you love to make that person the head of your home? Stop and think about it. And if you say, no, I don't like that, then now you've got a serious problem, because you realize that your faith in Christ requires you to submit to a man who gave everything up so that you could have everything. You see, your husband is to be a model of Jesus in the home. It's not about your husband, and it's not about you and your petty grievances. Now, I said earlier there were a couple things we needed to take into account here. And one of them is we got, remember what Jesus said, go back, keep going back. I learned this a few years ago, and it kind of just one of those light bulb moments. You remember in the story of the garden, and these stories seem so elementary and so simple, and we teach them to kids and we move on. They've got deep truths in them. He comes to Adam, he says, what have you done? He says, the woman you gave me, she gave me the fruit and I ate it. And he goes, the woman, what have you done? The serpent. And so God starts with the serpent and says, in your belly you're going to crawl, dust you'll eat, blah, blah, blah. And he goes to the woman. He says, because you've done this, in pain you'll bring forth children, right? Your conception. But there's a little thing there at the end, and boy, if you go read a commentary on this, there's all kind of crazy ideas about what he says here. But he says, your desire shall be for your husband, but he shall rule over you. There have been a lot of bad teaching from that text. Some people have said that was attraction. The desire there was that as a curse for you ladies, you're going to be attracted to these old muley-headed men. That's not what he's saying. In fact, we have divine commentary on it. You can read it there in Genesis chapter 3, right there in 15 down through 20. You can go and read it where he says it to that woman, your desire shall be for your husband, he shall rule over you. And then you go to chapter 4, and we have the story of Cain and Abel. And Cain kills his brother Abel out in the field, and his blood is soaking in the dirt. And God said, where's your brother Abel? And Cain says, am I my brother's keeper? And God comes to him. He says, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. And God says to Cain, he says, if you do well, will you not be approved? And he says this, he says, sin's desire is for you, but you shall rule over it. In Hebrew, it's the exact same sentence that God said to Eve. Now, we don't have any problem understanding the second one, do we? He said, Cain, sin wants to control you. Sin wants to have dominion over you, but you are to assert your control over it. And that's what he says to the woman. Same exact thing. And what he says is part of your curse is now, part of the fall, part of this broken system that's not like it was in the garden is that I created you for the man, but now you're going to resent the fact that he is the head of your house. There's going to be an innate desire to want to control him and tell him what to do, but he will have rule over you. And so we have that divine commentary, and what God is telling the woman is that submitting to your husband will not be pleasant, it will not be fun, and it's not going to feel natural, and you likely will resent it. Why do we have so much anger towards men in the 20th and 21st century? It's God talked about it in Genesis 3. We hear so much today about the evil patriarchy. There are men who are malicious and selfish and chauvinistic and misogynistic, all those things that fit that bill. Absolutely. And those men should be shamed. But the biblical husband that leads his home is a man who lays down his life for his wife. And so let me offer some suggestions from this passage, or from these passages. And the first one is this. Women, and I'm starting with you because God did, okay? Trust me, men, we got the tougher load here. Ladies, if you want your home to be blessed, you want your marriage to be happy, do all you can to respect your husband. If he does the laundry and he folds the towels two times, but you like them folded three times, or when you load the dishwasher, you want the cups on this rack, but he put them on that rack, it's really easy to be critical of him. And you will do more damage to him in that criticism. Because remember, you're his easer. You're his help. You're the thing that makes him complete. And I'm going to tell you a secret, and you can abuse this and destroy men, or you can use it to build up your man into a godly man. I'm going to tell you a secret that every man in here is ashamed to utter. I don't mind telling you today. Every one of us husbands relies so much on the approval and the admiration of our spouses. You ever heard the old saying, behind every good man's a good woman? Or behind every good man's or a great man, there's a better woman, etc. You know why? Because a wise woman builds her husband up and makes him stronger and does not criticize and tear him down. Now, I'm not trying to accuse anyone, but you know, I can't think of anything that would hurt a husband worse than to walk up and hear his wife telling a joke at his expense. That's a good way to destroy your home. Now, the devil wants you to do that. And he's going to use your natural resentment of his headship to criticize him. Don't do it. Remember, you married him. And the day you married him, you didn't want anybody else. You wanted him, right? Now, to the husbands, it's our turn. It's easy to get caught up and be selfish. But where our wives are called by God to learn submission, by the way, which is a characteristic of being a child of God, do you know what we're called to learn? We're called to learn sacrifice. Do you know that for all the argument today about wage inequality, did you know that the overwhelming majority of workplace deaths are men? Do you know the overwhelming majority of overtime worked is by men? Do you know more men work themselves to death? It's innate, and it's part of, we're expected to do that, right? If there's a lightning storm and there's a blowout, you know, I don't say, hey, Melissa, you better get that changed. I'm going to hang in here, me and Benjamin going to listen to the radio, right? I wouldn't be a man. Men, we're called to be the ones who get out in the lightning and in the rain. We're called to be the ones who work overtime. We're called to be the one who protects the home. And we all understand that is the natural order, but it is incumbent on us to learn selflessness to do that. And one of the main problems in our world today is we can't find husbands for our women who are learning. They're still wanting to play video games and sit in the basement at age 35. And they've never been taught to be selfless and sacrifice and get out and work and get out there and kill themselves on the altar of sacrifice for their families. Because that's what... Now, you say, you want everyone to kill themselves? No, it's a metaphor, right? We are sacrificing ourselves for the betterment of our family. And if you say, well, that's a terrible idea, that's exactly what Jesus did. He went to the cross. He says, even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give His life a ransom for many. Husbands, it's not about what we get out of the relationship. It's about what we do for the others in that relationship. And so we are to sacrifice and be selfless. Well, I ain't got to go play golf, or I ain't got to go fish. That's fine. You know, we have some husbands that, it's hunting season, honey. I'll see you in the spring. That's nonsense. And it's selfish. And it's godless. And it's cowardly. Your job, husbands, is to make sure your wife is taken care of first and foremost, and then your children. You know, we're going to see next week that nowhere in the Bible does it say, mothers, raise your children. It says, fathers, raise your children. You know why? Because guess what comes with being head of the home? Responsibility. Well, she's going to take care of that. No, it's you. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to do all the work and organize all the stuff. But listen, I don't know where some of Benjamin's stuff is even located, because Melissa's got that stuff filed away. But as husbands, we're called to sacrifice. And so here's the thing we do, husband. Did you notice over in Colossians 3 and 18, he said, do not be harsh towards your wife. And over in 1 Peter chapter 3, and a lot of people take offense at that statement there about the weaker vessel, but we all understand, you know, men are like waffles, women are like spaghetti. That, emotionally, women are more cued towards an emotional base, men more towards a rational base. This isn't rocket science. Every psychological study ever done on this proves this out. And this is why women are better nurturers. This is why they're better at taking care of screaming babies. And men, we think, you know, I'm not sure the cost-benefit analysis on this is really good. We might ought to chunk this thing or put him on eBay. If it weren't for mothers, I'm not sure the kids would make it to adulthood. And so in a very real sense, men, we can sort of slough off our emotions and go and do what's right. And our women can recenter us and say, you need to have some compassion. Because God took from us to make her. So together, we're now a whole. You see, it's not that one is superior to the other or one's inferior to the other. It's that together, we're what we can be. And in our distinct natures, we can accomplish different things and work together. Can you give us the final slide? Thank you so much. The final thing I want to talk about here is the meaning of marriage. We talked about the model of marriage. We talked about the mechanics of marriage. Now I want to talk about the meaning of marriage. And this is one that to be honest, we don't think about enough. And in fact, if you're going to join our Married Couples Bible Study that we're about to start after camp, we'll probably start in July, that book I put on Facebook a month or so back, we're going to talk a lot about this in that study. It's so important. Paul says there in Ephesians 5, he says, this is a great mystery, but I speak concern. He's been talking about husbands and wives. We can read that. Okay, wives need to do this and respect their husbands. Okay, husbands need to sacrifice and take care of their wives. Okay, got it. And Paul says, you know, this is a great mystery, but I'm not talking about husbands and wives at all. I speak concerning Christ and His church. And it sort of just throws us for a tailspin. Because if you're reading that for the first time and you've never read that before, you're all in on the marriage instructions, right? Okay, this is how husbands should behave and this is how wives should behave. And Paul says, actually, we're talking about Jesus and His church. And what we learn is your marriage is not about making you happy or fulfilling your needs or whatever. It's about making you holy and more like your God. I got a book in my office, His Needs, Her Needs. I've read it. I've recommended it to married couples. I think it's a good practical book, but it's all about, hey, wives, this is what your husband needs from you, and husbands, this is what your wives need from you. Great book, great practical book. If you're having problems, it's not a bad book to go and read. But it doesn't say one word in that book about marriage is all about being more like Jesus. And so here's how it works. We talked about it just a moment ago. Husbands, we learn to sacrifice as Christ did. And in taking on the responsibility of a home, men mature. And in sacrifice, everyone who goes through sacrifice is made better. Wives learn to submit as to the Lord. One of the hardest things to do, and I think this is more admirable than learning to sacrifice, is learning to submit. Because, you know, I want to do what I want to do. And telling my will no is hard. But that's exactly what the cross calls me to, is to call me to self-denial and sacrifice. And so in our marriages, God uses marriage as a tool to help us be more holy so we can be more like Him, so we can get to heaven. And did you notice that while we both learn to be more like God, there's also a peripheral benefit? He talks about wives, and by the way, this would apply to husbands as well, but back in the ancient world, it would have more probably applied to wives more often. But to wives, he says, if your husband is an unbeliever, he's like, what do you do in that situation? We read that there in 1 Peter chapter 3. He says, your spouse might be won by your godly conduct. You know what'll freak out a spouse? If you start being really good to them and you haven't been in the past. You say, well, my spouse is not a Christian and they're kind of a rough person. Should I just separate since I'm a Christian? No. You treat them like Jesus would treat them. You'd be even nicer to them. Do extra for them. Do more. Go over and above. And they're going to get suspicious. And they're going to start wondering, is there arsenic in my pancake this morning? And then you say, no, I love you because Jesus told me to love you. And because I love Jesus, and you're made in the image of God. You say, we wouldn't talk like that around the dinner table. Well, we need to learn to, because we're Christian people. And do you know how many men have had their hard hearts broken by a kind, loving wife who treated them with respect, even though they did not deserve an ounce of it? Think about that. You see, marriage at the end of the day is not about me. It's about helping this other person make their way to heaven. And so that's what marriage is all about.